Look to Windward. Cassette 6.
Zilla gazed through the side windows as the swaying car tipped in a gust of wind and then, still creaking and rattling, picked up speed along the monofill cable. "Surprised you're not with him, Kabe," Zilla said, glancing at the Hommomdan. "I thought the idea was you had to hold his hand while he's here."
"The Major hopes that I might be able to persuade you to grant him an audience," Kabe said. "Obviously, I can't do much persuading if I never leave his side."
Zilla inspected Kabe over the top of the chart. "Tell me, Kabe, is that him trying to be disarmingly honest through you, or just your usual naivety?" Kabe laughed.
"A little of each, I think."
Zilla shook his head. He tapped at the chart with the magnifying glass.
"What do all these cable lines cross-hatched in pink and red mean?" he asked.
"The pink lines have been judged unsafe," the Avatar said. "The red ones are the stretches that have fallen down." Zilla held up the chart towards the Avatar. He indicated one area the size of his hand.
"You mean you can't use these bits at all?"
"Not in a cable car," the Avatar agreed.
"You just let them fall down?" Zilla said,
staring at the chart again and sounding, Kabe thought, distinctly peeved. The Avatar shrugged. "Like I said, they weren't my responsibility in the first place. Nothing to do with me whether they stand or fall, unless I choose to adopt them as part of my infrastructure. And given that hardly anybody uses them these days, I'm not about to. Anyway, I kind of enjoy their gradual entropic decay."
"I thought you people built to last," Kabe said.
"Oh," said the Avatar brightly, "if I'd built the pylons, I'd have anchored them into the base material. That's the main reason the lines have collapsed or are unsafe. The pylons have been washed away in floods. They weren't founded on the substrate, just the geolayer, and not very far into that. A big flood comes along after a supercyclone and whoomph, a bunch of them fall down. Plus the monofill's so strong, it can drag whole lines down once the first one or two pylons get washed into the flood streams. They didn't put enough safety brakes into the cables. There have been four big storms since the system was finished. I'm surprised more of it hasn't been compromised."
"Still, it does seem a shame to let it all fall into such disrepair," Kabe said.
The Avatar looked up at him.
"You really think so? I thought there was something rather romantic about it crumbling slowly away. For a work of such self-referential artifice to be attritionally sculpted by what passes for the forces of nature around here seemed appropriate to me."
Kabe thought about this.
Zilla was studying the chart again.
"What about these lines hatched in blue?" he asked.
"Oh," said the Avatar, "those just might be unsafe." Zilla's face took on an expression of consternation. He held up the chart.
"But we are on a blue line."
"Yes," the Avatar said, looking up through the glass panels in the center of the rustic painting, where the car's guide and steering wheels could be seen sliding along the cable.
"Hmm," it said.
Zilla put the chart down, crumpling it.
"Hub," he said, "are we in any danger?"
"No, not really. There are safety systems. Plus, if there was a failure and we fell off the wire, I could zap down an AG platform before we'd fallen more than a few meters. So, as long as I'm all right, we all are."
Zilla looked suspiciously at the silver-skinned creature lying on the couch, then returned to his chart.
"Have we settled on a venue for the first performance of my symphony yet?" he asked, not looking up.
"I thought the Stullion Bowl on Guano," the Avatar said. Zilla looked up. Kabe thought he looked both surprised and pleased.
"Really?"
"I think I have little choice," the Avatar said. "Been a lot of interest. Need a maximum capacity venue?"
Zilla smiled broadly and looked to be about to say something. Then he smiled almost bashfully, Kabe thought, and buried his head in the chart again.
Zilla, the Avatar said, Major Quillen has asked me to ask you if you'd mind him moving to Akeem City.
Zilla put the chart down.
What?
He hissed.
Yawl is very nice, but it's quite different from Akeem, the Avatar said. It's warm, even at this time of year. He wants to experience the same conditions you do up there on the Massif.
Send him to the top of a bulkhead range, Zilla muttered, taking up the magnifying glass again.
Would it concern you? The Avatar asked. You're hardly there these days, anyway.
It's still where I prefer to lay my head most nights, Zilla said. So, yes, it would concern me.
Then I should tell him you'd prefer he didn't move there.
Yes.
Are you sure? He wasn't asking to move in next door, just somewhere in the city centre.
Still too close for comfort.
Hub, Kabe began. The Avatar said. He said he'd be happy to let you know where he was, so you wouldn't bump into...
Oh, dear fucking God!
Zilla threw the chart down and shoved the magnifying glass into a waistcoat pocket.
Look, I don't want the guy here. I don't want him anywhere near me. I don't want to meet him, and I don't like being told that even if I want to, I can't get away from the son of a bitch.
My dear Zilla, Kabe said, then stopped.
I'm starting to sound like Tersono, he thought.
The Avatar brought its boots down off the top of the couch and swung itself into a sitting position.
Nobody's forcing you to meet the fellow, Zilla.
Yes, but nobody's letting me get as far away from him as I'd like, either.
You're a long way from him now, Kabe pointed out.
And how long did it take us to get from there to here?
Zilla asked. They had come by subplate car that morning. The whole journey had taken just over an hour.
Well...
I'm practically a prisoner, Zilla said, spreading his arms.
The Avatar's face contorted.
No, you're not, it said.
I might as well be. I haven't been able to write a note since that bastard showed up.
The Avatar sat up, looking alarmed.
But you have finished the...
Zilla waved one hand exasperatedly.
It's complete. But I usually wind down with shorter pieces after something this big, and this time I haven't been able to. I feel constipated.
Well, Kabe said, if you might as well be forced into contact with Quillen, why not see him and get it over with?
The Avatar groaned and flopped back on the couch. It put its feet up again. Zilla was staring at Kabe.
Is that it? He asked. Is that you using your powers of argument to convince me I should see this piece of shit?
From your tone, Kabe said, voice rumbling, I take it you are not persuaded.
Zilla shook his head.
Persuasion? What's reasonable? Would I mind? Am I concerned? Would I be insulted? I may do as I please, but then so may he,
Zilla pointed angrily at the Avatar.
You people are polite to the point of it becoming worse than any direct insult. All this pussy-footing, mealy-mouthed bullshit, dancing round each other. After you, no, after you, no, after you.
He waved his arms around as his voice rose to a shout.
I hate this hopeless congealment of fucking good manners. Can't anyone just do something?
Kabe thought about saying something, then decided not to. The Avatar looked mildly surprised. It blinked a few times. Such as what? It inquired. Would you prefer that the Major called you out and challenged you to a duel? Or moved in next door?
You could kick him out.
Why would I do that?
Because he's annoying me.
The Avatar smiled. Zilla, it said.
I feel hunted. We're a predator species. We're only used to hiding when we're stalking. We're not used to feeling like prey.
You could move home, Kabe suggested.
He'd follow me.
You could keep moving.
Why should I? I like my apartment. I like the silence and the views. I even like some of the people. There are three concert halls in Akeem with perfect acoustics.
Why should I be driven from the place just because Chell sends this military bag boy to do God knows what?
What do you mean, God knows what? Asked the Avatar.
Maybe he isn't here just to talk me into going back with him. Maybe he's here to kidnap me, or kill me.
Oh, really, Kabe said.
Kidnap's impossible, Hub said. Unless he brought a fleet of warships I've missed. The Avatar shook its head. Murder is almost impossible. It frowned. Attempted murder is always possible, I suppose. But if you were worried, I could make sure that if and when you did meet, there would be a few combat drones and knife missiles and that sort of thing around. And of course you could be backed up.
I am not, Zilla said deliberately, going to need combat drones and knife missiles or backing up, because I am not going to meet him.
But he's obviously annoying you just by being here, Kabe said.
Oh, does it show? Zilla asked, snarling.
So, assuming that he's not going to get bored and go away, Kabe went on, you'd almost be better off agreeing to see him and getting it over with.
Will you stop this getting it over with nonsense? Zilla shouted.
Talking of not being able to get away from people, the Avatar said heavily, E.H. Tersono has discovered our whereabouts and would like to drop by.
Ha!
Zilla said, whirling round to look out of the windscreen again.
I can't get away from that damn machine either.
It means well, Kabe said.
Zilla looked round, appearing genuinely mystified.
So?
Kabe sighed.
Is Tersono nearby? He asked the Avatar.
It nodded. It's already on its way here, about 10 minutes away, flying in from the nearest tunnel port. More than just the terrain made the breaks wasteland. There were only a few subplate access points, and they were all on the outskirts of the area. So to get deep into the barrens at more than walking trail pace, you either had to use the cable car system or fly.
What does it want?
Zilla checked the wind gauge, then loosened two ropes and tightened another, to no appreciable effect. Social visit, it says, the Avatar told him. Zilla tapped a gimbaled horizontal dial.
You sure this compass works?
Are you accusing me of not having a viable magnetic field? The hub asked.
I was asking you if this thing works.
Zilla tapped the instrument again. Should do, the Avatar said, putting its clasped hands behind its head again. Very inefficient way of determining your heading, though.
I want to head into the wind on the next turn, Zilla said,
looking ahead to the hill they were approaching and the stubby pylon at its scrubby summit. You'll need to start the propeller.
Oh, Kabe said. They have propellers?
Big two-bladed things stowed at the back, the Avatar said,
nodding to the rear, where two curved windows cupped a broad panelled section.
Battery-powered. Should be charged up if the generator vanes are working. How do I determine that?
Zilla asked. He pulled his pipe from a waistcoat pocket. See the big dial on the right, just under the windscreen, with a lightning flash symbol?
Yes.
Is the needle in the brown-black section or the bright-blue section? Zilla peered. He stuck his pipe in his mouth.
There is no needle.
The Avatar looked thoughtful. That could be a bad sign. It sat up and looked about. The pylon was about 50 meters away. The ground was rising underneath them.
I'd ease off on that mizzen sheet.
The what?
Slacken the third rope from the left.
Ah! Zilla loosened the rope and tied it off again. He pulled on a couple of levers, braking the car and readying the steering wheels above. He clicked a couple of large switches and looked hopefully towards the rear of the car. He caught the Avatar's gaze.
Oh, let that fucking emissary move to Akeem, he said in an exasperated voice. See if I care. Just keep us apart.
Certainly, the Avatar said, grinning. Then its expression changed.
Uh-oh,
it said, It was staring straight ahead. Kabe felt a spark of worry leap in his breast.
What? Zilla said. Is Tersono here already?
Then he was thrown off his feet, as with a crashing, tearing noise, the cable car decelerated rapidly and came to a shuddering, swaying stop. The Avatar had slid along the couch. Kabe had been thrown forwards, only stopping himself from falling on his face by putting out one arm and bracing himself on the brass rail separating the passenger compartment from the cruise area. The brass rail bent and came away from the bulkhead on one side with a creak and a bang. Zilla ended up sitting on the floor between two of the instrument binnacles. The car rocked to and fro. Zilla spat out a piece of his pipe.
What the fuck was that?
I think we snagged a tree, the Avatar said, sitting upright. Everybody all right?
Fine, said Kabe. Sorry about this rail.
I've bitten my pipe in half, Zilla said.
He picked one half of his severed pipe up from the floor. It'll repair, the Avatar said. It pulled back the carpet between the couches and lifted open a wooden door. Wind gusted in. The creature lay on the floor and stuck its head out.
Yes, it's a tree, it shouted.
It levered itself back inside.
Must have grown a bit since the last time anybody used this line.
Zilla was picking himself up.
Of course, it wouldn't have happened if you'd been responsible for the system, would it?
Of course not, the Avatar said breezily. Shall I send a repair drone, or shall we try and fix it ourselves?
I have a better idea, Zilla said,
smiling as he looked out of a side window. Kabe looked too, and saw a mainly rose-coloured object flying through the air towards them. Zilla slid open a window on that side and turned to his two companions with a smile before hailing the approaching drone.
Tersono! Good to see you! Glad you're here! See that mess down below?
Chapter 10 The Sea Stacks of Yumie.
And was Tersono equal to the task? More than equal physically, Hub tells me, despite its protestations that it risked tearing itself apart. However, I think that whatever empowers its will is also charged with maintaining its dignity, and so is normally pretty much fully occupied with that.
But was it able to free your car from the tree?
Yes, finally, though it took its time, and it made a terrible mess of things. It shredded the car's mainsail, broke the mast, and cut away half the tree.
And what of Zilla's pipe?
Bitten in half. Hub repaired it for him.
Ah, I was wondering if I might have made him a present of a replacement.
I'm not sure he'd take it in the spirit it was meant, Quill. Especially as it's something he would be putting in his mouth.
You suspect he might think I was trying to poison him?
It might occur to him.
I see. I still have a way to go, don't I?
Yes, you do.
And how much further do we have to go here, on our walk?
Another 3 or 4 kilometers,
Kabe looked up at the sun.
We should be there nicely in time for lunch.
Kabe and Quillen were walking along the cliff tops of the Vilster Peninsula on Fazan Plate. To their right, 30 meters below, Fazan Ocean beat against the rocks. The haze horizon swam with scattered islands. Closer in, a few sailboats and larger craft cut through the spreading patterns of the waves. A cool wind came off the sea. It whipped Kabe's coat about his legs, and Quillen's robes snapped and fluttered about him as he led the way along the narrow path through the tall grass. To their left, the ground sloped away to deep grassland, and then a forest of tall cloud trees. Ahead, the land rose to a modest headland and a ridge, heading inland, notched with a cleft for one branch of the path they were on. They were taking the more strenuous and exposed route along the cliff top. Quillen turned his head to look down towards the waves,
falling against tumbled rocks at the cliff's base. The smell of brine was the same here.
Remembering again, Quill?
Yes.
You're close to the edge. Mind you don't fall.
I will. Snow was falling in the courtyard of the monastery of Cadrasset, sinking gently from a silent grey sky. Quillan had brought up the rear of the firewood foraging detail, preferring to walk in solitude and silence as the others trudged up the trail ahead. The other monks had all gone inside to the warmth of the great hall's hearth by the time he closed the postern door behind him, scuffed through the light covering of snow on the courtyard stones, and dumped his basket of wood with the rest under the gallery. He dallied a moment, soaking up the fresh, clean smell of the wood. He remembered a time when they'd taken a hunting cabin in the Lustrian hills, just the two of them. The axe that came with the cabin was blunt. He'd sharpened it with a stone, hoping to impress her with his handiness. But then, when he'd come to swing it at the first piece of wood, the head had sailed off and disappeared into the trees. He could still exactly recall her laughter, and then, when he must have looked hurt, her kiss. They had slept under firs on a platform of moss. He remembered one cold morning when the fire had gone out overnight, and it was freezingly cold in the cabin, and they had coupled, him straddling her, his teeth nipped gently in the fur at the nape of her neck, moving slowly over and in her, watching the smoke of her breath as it billowed in the sunlight and rolled out across the room to the window, where it froze in curving, recursive motifs, a coalescence of pattern out of chaos. He shivered, blinking away cold tears. When he turned away, he saw the figure, standing in the centre of the courtyard, looking at him. It was a female, dressed in a cloak falling half open over an army uniform. The snow fell between them in soundless spirals. He blinked, just for an instant. He shook his head, brushed his hands together and walked out to her, putting up the hood of his griefling robe. He realized, as he made those few steps, that he hadn't even seen a female in the flesh for half a year. She did not look like Warasai at all. She was taller, her fur was darker, and her eyes looked more narrowed and wizened. He guessed she was 10 or so years older than him. The pips on her cap identified her as a colonel. "Can I help you, ma'am?" he asked. "Yes, Major Quillan," she said, in a precise, controlled voice. "Perhaps you can." Fronipel brought them both goblets of mulled wine. His office was about twice the size of Quillan's cell, and cluttered with papers, screens, and the ancient fraying string frames which were the holy books of the order. There was just enough room for the three of them to sit. Colonel Hegeline warmed her hands round the goblet. Her cap lay on the desk at her side, her cloak across the seat back. They had exchanged a few pleasantries about her journey, up the old road by mount, and her role during the war in charge of a space artillery section. Fronipel settled himself slowly into his second-best curl chair, the best had been given to the colonel, and said, "I asked Colonel Hegeline to come here, Major. She is familiar with your background and history. I believe she has a proposal for you." The colonel looked as though she would have been happy to have spent rather more time approaching the reason for her visit, but gave a shrug of good grace and said, "Yes, Major. There is something you might be able to do for us." Quillan looked at Fronipel, who was smiling at him. "Who would the us here be, Colonel?" he asked her. "The army?" The colonel frowned. "Not really. The army is involved, but this would not, strictly speaking, be a military assignment. It would be more like the one you and your wife undertook on Eorm, though even further afield, and on a quite different level of security and importance. The us I refer to would be all Chelgrians, but especially those whose souls are currently held in limbo. Quinnan sat back in his seat. And what would I be expected to do? I can't tell you exactly yet. I am here to find out if you will even consider undertaking the mission. But if I don't know what it is... Major Quinnan, the Colonel said, taking a small sip of her steaming wine, and then, after a minimal nod to Fronipel to acknowledge the drink, putting the goblet down on the desk. I'll tell you all I can. She drew herself up a little straighter in the seat. The task we would ask you to undertake is one that is very important indeed. That is almost all I know about that aspect of it. I do know a little more, but I'm not allowed to talk about it. The mission would require that you undergo a considerable amount of training. Again, I can't say much more about that. The clearance for the mission comes from the top of our society. She took a breath. And the reason that it doesn't matter too much at this stage exactly what it is you are being asked to do is that in one sense what's being asked of you is as bad as it gets. She looked into his eyes. This is a suicide mission, Major Quinnan. He had forgotten the sheer pleasure of staring into a female's eyes, even if she was not Warasai, and even if that pleasure, like some emotional internalization of physical law, created an equal and opposite feeling of grief and loss, and even guilt. He gave a small, sad smile. Oh. In that case, Colonel, he said, I'll definitely do it.
Quill?
Hmm?
He turned to face the tall triangular bulk of the Homamdan, who had bumped into him. Are you all right? You stopped very suddenly there. Did you see something?
Nothing. No, I'm fine. I'm fine. Come on, I'm hungry.
They walked on.
I just recalled. The Lady Colonel told me this is a one-way mission.
Ah, yes. There is that.
It is all coming back, isn't it?
Unlike us, yes. That's the way they've arranged it. That's what we both agreed to. It seems to have worked so far.
You knew too, then?
Yes. That was part of Visquile's briefing.
Which is why they kept you backed up in that substrate.
Which is why they kept me backed up in that substrate.
Well, I can't wait for the next installment.
He reached the summit of the cliff path and saw the town, a scimitar of white towers and spires, lying cradled in a bowl of wooded valley bordered by rising chalk cliffs, its bay protected from the sea by a spit of sand. Waves beat whitely on the strand. The Homamdan joined him, standing massively at his side and all but blocking out the wind. There was a hint of rain in the air. The following day, she left her mount in the monastery stables with her uniform. She dressed in the waistcoat and leggings of a handed. He was to impersonate a crafted, so wore trousers and an apron. They both put on nondescript grey winter cloaks. He said goodbye to Fronipel, but to nobody else. They waited until all the work parties had left before leaving the monastery. Then they walked down the lower path through the falling snow and the bare husks of spall trees, past the distant wood-gatherers, their songs heard through the quietly falling snow, as though they were the voices of ghosts, down through a level of wispy cloud where the colonel's grey cloak seemed almost to disappear at times, and then through the drumming rain beneath, and the dripping forest of dark leaves that descended towards the valley floor, where they turned and followed the deeply shaded track above the river, rushing whitely in the chasm below. The rain slackened and ceased. A group of Talia caste hunters in an old all-terrain on their way back from the forests after stalking Jedge
offered them a lift, but they refused politely. The trailer behind the all-terrain was piled with the carcasses of the animals. It bounced down the track into the gloom with its cargo of the dead, so that from then on they followed a line of fresh blood spots. Finally, in the foothills of the grey mountains, towards sunset, they came out onto the girdling turnpike, where cars and trucks and buses hummed past, trailing spray. A large car was waiting for them by the roadside. A young male, who looked uncomfortable in civilian clothes, opened the door for them and completed three-quarters of a salute to the colonel before remembering. The vehicle's interior was warm and dry. They took off their cloaks. The car swung out onto the road and set off down the route towards the plains. The colonel plugged into a military comm set in a briefcase on the rear seat and left him to his own thoughts as she sat with eyes closed, communicating. He watched the traffic. The outskirts of the city of Ubrent sparkled out of the gloom. It looked in better repair than the last time he'd seen it. Within an hour, they had reached the airport and a sleek black suborbiter sitting on the mist-curdled runway. He was about to reach out and touch the colonel to let her know they'd arrived when she opened her eyes, slipped the induction coil from the back of her head, and nodded at the aircraft as though to say, "We're here." The acceleration pressed him firmly back into the frame seat. He saw the lights of the coastal cities of Sherjame, the mid-ocean islands of Delium, and the small sparks of oceanic ships. Above, the stars became bright and steady and looked very close in the ghostly silence of near-vacuum flight. The suborbiter plunged back into the atmosphere in a gathering roar. There were a few lights, then a smooth touchdown and deceleration. He dozed in the closed transport, which took them away from the private field. When they transferred to a helicopter, he could smell sea. They flew briefly in darkness and rain, and clattered down into a great circular courtyard. He was shown to a small, comfortable room, and fell promptly asleep. In the morning, waking to a thudding, not quite regular booming noise, and the distant screeches of birds, he opened the shutters to look down over a sheer gulf of air at a blue-green sea, streaked with foam and breaking waves, boiling round a jagged coastline 50 meters away and 100 down. A line of cliffs vanished into the distance on either side, and immediately opposite him there was a huge double bowl cut out of the cliffs, so that the drop from the bottom of the bowl to the sea was only 30 meters or so. Clouds of seabirds wheeled in the sunlight, like scraps of foam blown up from the fretful sea. He recognized this place. He had seen it in books and on screen. The sea stacks at Umie were part of an extensive cliff system on mainland, one of the Tailquiff Islands, which lay in a long curved line to the east of Meirin. The cliffs dropped between 200 and 300 meters into the ocean, and the 17 sea stacks, the remains of great arches that the ocean's swells and waves had first created and then destroyed, rose like the fingers of 2 drowning people. Local legend had once held that they were the fingers of a pair of drowning lovers who'd thrown themselves from the cliffs rather than be forced to marry others. The stacks were named as though they were fingers, and the last and smallest of them, which was only 40 meters above the waves, was called the Thumb. The others ranged between 100 and 200 meters in height, and were about the same circumference where the sea washed incessantly around their bases, tapering slightly to their basalt summits. Building had begun upon them 4,000 years earlier, when the area's ruling family had constructed a single small stone castle on the stack nearest the cliff top, and linked the two by a wooden bridge. As the family's power had grown, so had the castle, until work was started on another stack, and then another and another. The fortress complex spread across the various rocky pinnacles, linked by a succession of bridges, at first wood, later stone, then later still iron and steel, and became a centre of government, a place of worship and pilgrimage, and a seat of learning. Over the centuries and millennia, every stack except the thumb had been permanently settled in some form or other, and it had even been a fortress for a while, equipped with heavy naval guns for a century or so. Gradually, the sea stacks had grown to become a city, with its greatest part ashore, spreading out over the heathland behind the cliffs. It had duly suffered the same fate as a handful of cities around the globe during the last unification war 1,500 years earlier, falling to a scatter of nuclear warheads, which demolished one stack completely, halved the height of another, and had left a crater shaped like a giant eight scooped out of the cliffs where most of the mainland districts had been. The city was never rebuilt. The sea stacks, cut off from the mainland by the twin craters, were derelict for centuries, a place for ghoulish tourism, and home only to a few hermits and a million seabirds. Two of the stacks became a monastery during one of Chell's more religious phases. Then the combined services had commandeered all of them as a training base, and rebuilt almost everything save for the bridges to the mainland, before moving off-world before the whole complex was finished, and leaving the stacks mothballed, with only a caretaker staff behind. Now it was his home. Quillen leant on a parapet and looked down to the white ruff of surf, washing the male's middle finger's base 300 meters below. The water looked slow from up here, he thought, as though each wave was tired from its long journey across the ocean, from wherever waves were born. He had been here for a 2 moon month. They were training him and assessing him. He still knew no more about the task beyond the fact that it was supposed to be a suicide mission. It was still not certain that he would be going on it. He knew that he was one of several contenders for the dubious honor. He had already agreed that if he was not chosen, he would submit to a memory wipe, which would leave him, apparently, just another war-traumatized monk in Cadrasset retreat, struggling to come to terms with his experiences. Colonel Hegeline was present about half the time, overseeing his training. His principal instructor in the arts and crafts of most things martial was a scarred, stocky, and taciturn male called Hwollum. He seemed obviously army or ex-army, but would admit to no rank. Quillen's other tutor was called Schwelfier, a frail, white-furred old male whose years and infirmity seemed to drop away from him when he was teaching. There were a few army specialists he saw every few days who obviously also lived in the complex, a handful of servants of various castes, and a number of blinded invisibles who had remained faithful to the old ways through the caste war. Quillen watched the blinded go about their duties, their upper faces covered by the green band of their rank, feeling their way with an easy familiarity, or using the high-pitched clicks they made with their claws to navigate their way amongst the concrete and rock-carved spaces of the stack. To be blinded here, with a drop to the rocks and the ocean, was, he thought, to put your faith forever in walls and thoughtful design. He was not allowed off this stack. He strongly suspected that some of his unseen comrade adversaries, the others who might be chosen to go on the mission rather than him, were on some of the other stacks across the long, locked bridges the combined services had thrown between the rocky columns. He held up one arm and studied his unsheathed claws. He turned his arm left and right. He had never been so muscled, so fit. He wondered if he really needed to be at such a physical peak for this mission, or whether the army, or whoever was really behind this, just trained you up like this as a matter of course. A large circular parade ground was located high up on the seaward side of the stack. It was open at the sides, but roofed by white awnings, like old-fashioned ship sails. There they had taught him fencing, trained him with a crossbow, and with projectile weapons and early laser rifles. They inculcated in him the finer and less fine points of fighting with knives and with teeth and claws. The point had been made that close-in fighting would differ when you tackled species other than your own, but it had been left at that. A small team of medics flew in one day and took him to a big but obviously rarely used hospital hollowed out of the rock deep beneath the stack's buildings. They equipped him with an improved soul keeper, but that was the only implant they touched or introduced. He had heard of agents and people on special missions being fitted with brain-linked communications rigs, poison-detection nasal glands, poison-producing sacs, subcutaneous weapon systems, the list was long. But he, apparently, was going to receive none of these. He wondered why. At one point, there was a hint that whoever undertook the mission might not be entirely alone. He wondered about that, too. Not all his training and education was martial. At least half of each waking day was spent being a student again, sitting in a curl chair, learning through screens or listening to Schwelfier. The old male instructed him in Chelgrian history, in religious philosophy, both before and after the partial sublimation of the Chelgrian Puen, and in the discovered history of the rest of the galaxy and its other sentient beings. He learned more than he'd ever imagined wanting or needing to know of what soul keepers did and how they did it, and what limbo and heaven were like. He learned where the old religion had been overly fanciful or just plain wrong in its assumptions and tenets, where it had inspired the Chelgrian Puen and so been made real, and where it had been superseded. He had no direct contact with any of the gone before, but he came to understand the afterlife better than he ever had before. Sometimes, knowing that it was almost beyond doubt that Warasai would never experience anything of this created glory, he felt that they had chosen him only to torture him, that all of this was an elaborate and cruel charade to find the knife of Warasai's loss that was forever buried in his flesh and twist it with all their might. He learned all there was to know about the caste war and the culture's involvement in the changes that had led to it. He learned about the personalities who had contributed to the war's background and listened to some of the music of Marai Ziller, at turns so achingly full of loss he cried, at others so full of anger he wanted to smash something. A number of suspicions and possible scenarios began to form in his mind, though he kept them to himself. Sometimes now he dreamt of Warasai. In one dream they were being married, here on the sea stack, and a great wind off the sea whipped people's hats away. He went to grab hers as it flew towards the parapet, and then crashed into the whitewashed concrete, tipping over it with her hat still just out of reach. He started to fall towards the sea, and felt himself gather in the breath for a scream, then recalled that, of course, Warasai wasn't really here, and could not be here. She was dead, and he might as well be. He smiled at the waves as they rushed up to meet him, and woke before he hit, with a feeling of somehow having been cheated, the salty dampness on his pillow like sea. One morning, he was walking across the parade ground beneath the snapping white tents of the awnings, heading towards Schwelfier's classroom for the first lecture of the day, when he saw a small group of people directly ahead. Colonel Hegelein, Hwalum, and Schwelfier were standing talking to the white and black-clothed figure in the middle of the group. There were five others, three on the right of the central group, two on the left. All were males dressed as clerks. The male in the middle was small and old-looking, with a sort of sideways hunch to his stance. It was something of a shock for Quillen to realize that the male was dressed in the black and white striped robe of an Estodienne, one of those who went between this world and the next. He wore a lopsided smile and held onto a long mirror staff. His fur looked slick, as though it had been oiled. Quillan was about to greet the colonel, but as he approached, the three people he knew dropped back to let the Estorien take a couple of small steps forward.
"Estorien," Quillan said, bowing deeply.
"Major Quillan,"
the old male said, in a soft, smooth voice. He reached his hand out to Quillan, who had become aware that the male standing on the extreme right of the group bulked out his clerical robes differently to the rest, and that this same male had started moving round to the side, as if starting to circle behind him. When the male disappeared from his view, the semi-shadow he cast by the attenuated light coming through the white awnings suddenly moved faster. What finally made Quillan certain he might be about to be attacked was something about the way that the old Estorien stretched when he reached out his hand. He was frail, and could not help but keep his distance from something that might prove violent. Quillan made as though to take the older male's hand, then ducked and spun, went back on his haunches, and brought his mid-limb and hands out in the classic pounce defense stance. The bulky-looking male, dressed as a clerk, had been about to strike. He had rocked back on his haunches, and his sleeves were rolled back to reveal tightly muscled arms, though his claws were only half exposed. There was a radiant, almost feral look on his white-furred face that lasted for a moment and even brightened for an instant as Quillan turned to confront him, but then he glanced at the Estorien and relaxed, sitting back and lowering his arms and his head in what might have been a bow.
This ends Side 1 of Cassette 6.